This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In 1948, tens of thousands of Palestinian villagers were driven from their homes to make way for settlers in the newly created state of Israel. In the studio with us to discuss how that incident still haunts the daily lives of every living Palestinian today are journalist Laila Al-Haddad and documentary filmmaker Yasmin Perni. They are in Malaysia for the 2014 Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival taking place from the 6th to 7th of September. Joining them in the studio is Yuzaidi Yusuf from Viva Palestina Malaysia, whose organization is responsible for putting together the festival. Yuzaidi, perhaps you can start us off by reminding us what Viva Palestina Malaysia is about and why it was founded.
Okay, I remember talking about this 2 years ago. We first had the inaugural KLPFF 2012. When we started back in 2008, December, a few of us actually sat down together and said, you know, we have to do something more than what, you know, just giving out monies and things like that. So we were very upset about what's happening then. And about 40 plus NGOs actually combined and sat together and decided to set up a bigger NGO to do something more than just donate money. So one thing led to another. And then Josh Galloway came over in 2009 and he suggested to us that for us to do a strong impact, it has to be global and concerted effort. So that's why Viva Palestina Malaysia was formed, and we worked together with other Viva Palestina in UK and other countries as well. So some of the objectives is actually to create the awareness and for cause to give aid to them, and also to help rebuild and free Palestine. That's our ultimate goal, to free Palestine.
This will be the third Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival. How does it differ from the previous festivals, and what do you hope to achieve this year?
The first couple of years when we had this, we were focusing very much on movies per se. And after a couple of years, we decided, I think let's expand this further. Let's go beyond just movies. Let's go beyond, look at cultures and arts. Hence why we decided to look at one, Laila, who is also an author, to bring, you know, talk about the books that she has written. And we have photography exhibition. So we are on to capture, and then also of course the books that we're going to be launching, which is Remember Us. And that book is focusing very much on youth, and then the author Laila will talk about mother cooking, which is going to capture the women, you know, who actually you know, those are the new areas that we want to focus more. And of course Yasmin, the movies that she has directed and produced, not just for the normal target. You know, you're looking at the Christians as well. A lot of people seem to forget that there are thousands of Christians as well in Palestine, that their voices need to be heard as well. So Yasmin will talk more about that.
Yasmin, your documentary, The Stones Cry Out, will be screened at the festival. What story did you want to tell through your film and why?
There are 2 points that I wanted to bring out. One is raise awareness on the fact that Palestinians are both Muslim and Christians. They both went through the same displacement, through the same pain of having to leave your house, being kicked out, killed, raped, drawn out in trucks. The fact that it happened to both people. I mean, there is no distinction. Both people went through the same thing. I say both people, actually, it's one people that went through the same really hard experience. It's called the catastrophe in Palestinian history, the Nakba. And the second point is that I wanted to break stereotypes. One is that many Palestinians most of our Palestinians are seen as terrorists, poor, refugees, Muslims. There is the awareness that they're Christian is very low.
Yeah.
And so through the film, I'm using a lot of imagery that shows you that they're wearing the same clothing. You will not see it in the film, but they go to the same schools. They live in the same villages, the same towns. They're neighbors, they're brothers, sisters. I mean, it's impossible to tell the difference between a Muslim and a Christian.
I suppose it's telling a story that the mainstream media, and presenting images that the mainstream media haven't necessarily done,
yes,
in that sense.
I don't think that a documentary that is focusing on the Christian have ever done before. And my role, you know, what I wanted to do is to give them a voice. It's the voices of the Palestinian Christians. And what I wanted is just to give them a voice, not having a foreign American, British, European expert give their interpretation or give their analysis of what it means. This is their, or have an Israeli voice. This was just let them tell their own stories in their own words. They're very capable of telling their own stories. They're the ones who, after all, went through this. So that's what I wanted to do, give them a voice.
Speaking of voice, the documentary is narrated by Paul Gordon Chandler. Who is he and how did you select who to speak for the film?
Paul Gordon was our priest in Cairo. I grew up in Egypt. And Paul Gordon was the priest of the church where I went to in Cairo. He's an Anglican priest. He is, like me, grew up all over the world. He lived in Egypt for many years. He had a good voice. As a preacher, he had a good voice. And I said, would you like to try? And he went through it like a professional. It was amazing. He was better than the professional. Because the last year I've translated the film into Spanish, French, Italian, Arabic. I can't remember if any other language. But he was so professional. He did it all in a go. We had to repeat. Maybe once we had to repeat one part of the script. But the rest, he flew right through it with the right intonation, with the right voice. You know, preachers have this kind of thing. Martin Luther King is the perfect example of a good voice.
The beauty of many decades of practice, I think.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
Laila, you were born in Kuwait to parents from Gaza, grew up in Saudi Arabia, and went to high school in Bahrain. What was your childhood like, and how did it reflect in your relationship with Gaza?
Well, on one hand, it was similar to many Palestinian childhoods. Most Palestinians actually live not within Palestine, but outside of it. And on the other, it was very confused, having somewhat of an identity crisis. You know, knowing we weren't Saudi citizens, knowing we were there temporarily, but sort of for a very long and extended period for nearly two decades. And then returning to Gaza, commuting to Gaza on a yearly basis in the summers. Again, always kind of feeling estranged from your own land and longing to be in that land and wanting a way to relate to it as well.
Could you explain, you know, that concept of one's relationship to land? Because I think for many people, especially people who have a country and can take citizenship for granted, so to speak, you know, you're born, you're where you are, that's all it is. We don't necessarily have that same pull. Could you tell us a little bit about that and your relationship to the idea of having a land to belong to?
Mm-hmm. I think even for Palestinians, many Palestinians who grew up in the Arabian Gulf might have taken this concept for granted of sort of belonging or having a place to return to, whereas other Palestinians, perhaps those who were active in the PLO in the 70s and 80s, you know, did not, was most famously, put into words by the late Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. He frequently and very eloquently talked about not having a land to return to and always being a stranger and so on. And has a great poem called Athens Airport, where he sits and waits as he was being sent into exile from Lebanon and, looking at the doors, the revolving doors, and saying, I have nowhere to return to. But anyway, I think it really hit home for a lot of Palestinians after the 1991 Gulf War, where tens of thousands of Palestinians were sent into exile for a second time, were kicked out of their jobs where they had worked for decades in the Gulf without precedent and had nowhere to go and ended up all over the place, some of them from my own family in Bulgaria and Iraq. And till this day, many of them still lack documentation in places like Iraq and Syria. And I think at that point it became clear how vulnerable Palestinians are. And that was something my parents always reminded us of, is never, you know, whereas a lot of our compatriots might have had, you know, something to fall back on, maybe some other citizenship. We never did. And my parents always reminded us that you have to remember that You never take for granted what you have, and that at any moment we could be shipped off. And that's why we have to renew our identity documents that we had, the Palestinian residency, because in the end that's where we belong and what we have to go to. But it's definitely this feeling of vulnerability, knowing at any time that you may be ejected from where you are located and you have no secure place to stay or to seek refuge in.
You eventually furthered your studies in the United States, obtaining a BA in political science from Duke University and a master's in public policy from Harvard. Did you have a career in mind that you were working towards?
I come from a long line of physicians, my father, my mother, my uncles, and my father always said to me, you know, don't go into medicine, do something else that that can be of more use or that few other Palestinians or Muslims have done. And so I got those degrees initially thinking sort of naively I could be involved in either in Palestinian like diplomacy or government or public policy, which is what I got my master's degree in. But just as I finished my graduate studies, the Second Intifada broke out, and it didn't seem very plausible that I would be able to. And with it, of course, dissipated the illusion that there was any kind of peace process. And so then I had to kind of rethink my strategy, and I ended up going into journalism, which I had been involved in throughout my college years, you know, editing various papers and writing columns. And I particularly liked listening to people's stories. That was something I liked, that style as well, of sharing people's stories and being able to document the Palestinian narrative that I felt was missing. And so I kind of angled towards that and away from policy and government per se.
And that's something that I want to get into after the break. I'm speaking today to Laila El-Haddad, author and journalist, as well as Yasmin Purdy, documentary filmmaker, and Yuzaidi Yusuf, part of the Central Committee for Viva Palestina Malaysia. We're talking about the question of Palestine, as well as the third Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined in the studio today by Laila El-Haddad, author and journalist, Yasmin Perni, documentary filmmaker, and Yuzaidi Yusuf, part of the Central Committee for Viva Palestina Malaysia. And we're talking about the question of Palestine as well as the third Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival. Laila, you mentioned before the break that your interests geared towards journalism after a while, and your most recent book is called The Gaza Kitchen. Why write a book about the food cooking and kitchens of Gaza?
It's really in an effort to draw things back to the human scale and make the Palestinian struggle more relatable, on one hand, to the Western world, but also to provide sort of a codified document of this folk knowledge for Palestinians themselves, as well as being able to provide them with images of themselves that they recognize, not very caricatured images of, you know, doom and gloom and bombings and war zones and so forth. So what the book basically does is it weaves together three different things. It weaves together very authentic and traditional recipes from the greater Gaza region, both prior to 1948 and after it. And it also includes political and economic analysis on various topics such as impact of the blockade on access to farmland and the fishing zones and the situation with water and on and on. And finally, we include profiles of mainly of women, but also of farmers and others as well. And again, this was in an effort to be able to, to say to the reader, look, we exist. We insist on existing. This is our way of resisting. And basically, it's this daily struggle to stay human for Palestinians. Beyond the headlines and beyond the bombed-out buildings, you have kitchens and homes and families that have to continue to endure and provide meals for their families. And can we, as a reader and outside world, imagine what that is like and what that entails? And sometimes we'll find that it's just as ordinary and simple as it would be for anybody else. And suddenly, when we have this kind of more personal relationship, it becomes more difficult, especially for residents of countries that might have governments who support Israeli policies. It becomes more difficult to support those policies when you have this kind of personal and intimate knowledge of life there.
And both yourself and Yasmin, I think what I'm hearing is also the importance of representation and fair representation of what it actually means to be a Palestinian, as well as I think something you said that struck me was the idea of having images that they themselves would recognize as, you know, being Palestinian. And how important is it to both of you to have that idea of representation as both to Palestinians as well as to people outside who may not understand?
I think it's quite important because, you know, again, when we were speaking about Palestinians, I wasn't sure what the reception would be. I was a bit nervous, you know. I had spent 3 years writing the book with my co-author, Maggie Schmidt, and I was really thrilled to find that it was received so well, not only in the Western world, but in Palestine itself. When I went back last year in June, and everybody was just ecstatic that there was, first of all, that there was this book that had something to do not just with, again, these sort of very stereotypical issues relating to Gaza, which is, of course, a part of and a very real part of the story, but that it involved something else and portrayed them as human beings and shared this knowledge with them. So it is, I think, very important. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yes, I wanted to make it so that the West and Europe can start to identify with the Palestinians. And I was actually surprised at the reaction that I got from the tours, because people, after seeing the film, will tell me, "Why didn't know about this?" And I said, the occupation has been going on for 66 years. Somehow, if they see it through Christian eyes, through a Christian narration, they seem to be able to identify better, which is extremely sad as far as I'm
concerned.
I guess
it's less of the perspective of the other, right? It's something that you can relate to.
It becomes part of you. And this is also why I start the film, for example, with black and white pictures from before 1948, because you can identify with a young couple going on honeymoon. These are old pictures, but they're also very relevant. I mean, it's my grandmother's pictures. It's the same pictures that they have or they had, and the same pictures that in the West we have. It's black and white. It's the wedding dress that was short at the time, not a long dress. It was portraits of a baptism or Christmas gifts. So you can relate to that in a more personal way. And this is what I was trying to do, break the barrier that we in the West are subjected to. We it's like the media puts in front of us these barriers, and we have to try and remove these barriers and identify with the Palestinians, because they're human beings.
In that same vein, food serves is something common, right? We all eat all over the world, and food, in the case of the Gaza Kitchen, the book, served as a means for people to identify with Palestinians, sort of a back door, another window, an entry to Gaza. And it really was surprising to see how many people were able to relate to the Palestinian struggle that would have otherwise been, you know, not just absent from the picture, but even staunch supporters of Israel or of Zionism. I had so many people come up to me in various presentations of the book in the United States that said to me, you know, I would have never thought to open or read anything that had to do that was supportive of the Palestinian struggle. And I was really shocked when I was convinced by a friend, for example, to open this and read about it, that I could relate or was familiar with so many of the stories that you write about and the recipes and so on.
You mentioned recipes. You'll be conducting a cooking demonstration this Sunday. What are the defining features of Palestinian cuisine?
Well, Palestinian cuisine, on one hand, is part of a geographic continuum with the rest of the Levant, so it shares much in common with Syrian, Lebanese, Jordanian cuisine. But the cuisine of Gaza is a bit more distinct, first of all, because Gaza has been isolated for so many decades, but also because so many hundreds of thousands of Palestinians poured into Gaza in 1948, sought refuge there, and were sealed in and unable to return to their homes, and they brought with them their various distinct culinary heritage. And as a result, you can experience all these various types of cuisines within tiny little Gaza. And so you have the influence partly of neighboring Egypt. You have the tastes of the farm lands in the rural areas of inland Palestine, and then you have the cuisine of the coast, rich with its seafood and the sophisticated tastes and spices of the urban areas as well of Gaza City. It's the city area of Gaza is utilizes a lot of spice, but also a lot of chilies, which is something, of course, very common here in Malaysia, but not so common in the Arab world. And so it's actually, that's probably the most stereotypical thing people associate with the cuisine of Gaza is the use of the chili pepper and the seafood, which is, of course, when you go just an hour east to the West Bank, they are completely isolated and from the sea, and so they don't have any seafood there.
Look, going back to Viva Palestina, Uzaidi, since the outbreak of war in Gaza more than 8 weeks ago, Viva Palestina Malaysia, or VPM, has released a statement denouncing the influx of disaster tourists under voluntourism schemes. How big a hindrance is that to humanitarian work in the region?
Oh, it is a hindrance. The thing is, we are bringing in aid, doctors into Gaza. It's already a problem. Right. So, and these medical doctors, when they are in Gaza, they are always vulnerable to any time of attack from the Israel. So you have someone who are in there as a tourist. So you're not actually just affecting the themselves, but also the people in Gaza. So and you know for a fact that in Gaza, a lot of basic requirements like electricity, water is already a lot of it's short. So by having someone in there, we're not doing anything at all, and just a tourist, it's not helping both them and also people in Gaza.
So what kind of work is Viva Palestina Malaysia specifically doing to kind of aid efforts in that area?
We work very closely with multiple organizations, mainly the medical associations, and we have our NGOs who are on the ground who we liaise with almost every other day, or if not every day, and it's in fact the recent attack in July, we received the direct responses from them on exactly what they want. And what they need. So whatever that we buy or we purchase or procure or bring aid to them is exactly what they want. So for example, if it's mattresses, if it's drinking water, whether it's ambulance, those are things that we buy. So we don't just give them what we think they need. We give them what they want and they need.
Laila, this is the third war in 5 years for people living in Gaza. You covered the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza back in 2005. What went wrong since?
Well, first of all, we as Palestinians, and I guess generally people of conscience all over the world, like to point out that it's not a war which implies a symmetrical conflict between two equal parties or governments, but rather an assault and an aggression on a besieged stateless people. And what went wrong is very simple. I think the problem is that much of the world's media covered the Israeli disengagement as though it were a withdrawal, meaning a end of the legal occupation and withdrawal of all military and return to sovereignty. So it kind of brings images of, Malaysian independence or whatever, when in reality it was simply a dismantlement of military infrastructure from within Gaza. So the Israeli settlements were dismantled and the military infrastructure was simply moved to the outside of Gaza. While Israel retained control over all of Gaza's effective markers of sovereignty, meaning they continue to control the airspace, the sea space, and all of the borders and the commercial crossings, as well as restrict the movement of people from between Gaza and the West Bank and Jerusalem and the rest of the world. So this is, in summation, what went wrong is that Israel never ended its occupation. It continued to control Gaza simply in a more strategic manner. And the same time that it actually disengaged from Gaza, Israel made room by way of settlement expansion in the West Bank for 30,000 new illegal settlers. So it just continued basically settler colonial regime and occupation throughout Palestine, and just again did so in a more sort of strategic manner for its part.
The idea of symmetry is one that I think is quite misunderstood, and one area of conflict, I suppose, in terms of policy or in terms of modern communication, is that Hamas is a terrorist organization that Israel has a right to defend itself against. Has the Palestinian Authority or Hamas been effective representatives for the Palestinian people?
I think, you know, it's irrelevant what we on the outside might think. We just have to look at the observable facts, excuse me. And those are that in 2006, Hamas's political party, which was the Change and Reform Movement, was elected to power in democratic elections. And actually, they were the first democratic elections in the Arab Middle East. And that really scared a lot of the region's governments. And as a matter of fact, they were amongst the first to vote in the Arab League to impose a siege upon Gaza. So it's not like we're, you know, unfairly shelling out criticism just to Western nations here. And so that is a fact. And, you know, another fact is that as an immediate response to the elections, economic sanctions were slapped on the Palestinians, followed by a blockade that exists till this day. So that is the reality. Now, it's, you know, irrelevant, again, not only what we think, but we have to remember that even if we were to assume that Israel's claim that they are targeting Hamas only was correct, which it's not, because, again, the facts tell us that more than three-fourths of the fatalities were unarmed civilians in this recent assault. But even if we were to assume that's correct, that doesn't give them the right to strike heavily populated areas and knowing that there are civilians there. And as a matter of fact, Palestinians have a right and an obligation under international law to be able to resist and to defend themselves, you know, as an occupied people. So it's sort of the narrative is skewed here. It's as though the Palestinians don't have a right to security or a right to self-defense. You know, I always say it's they as the besieged and occupied people that have a precedent for this right more than anything.
Since 2005, Palestinian civil societies have called upon the world to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. How effective has the BDS movement been?
I can add a few cents and then we can go to another contributor. But it's been very effective, as a matter of fact. Of course, it has to be well understood because sometimes in nations that are you know, naturally supportive of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice, you know, have a very emotional knee-jerk reaction and, you know, let's boycott McDonald's and Starbucks and whatever and don't really understand what the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement is about, which was it was a call put out by Palestinian civil society asking to have a consumer, cultural and academic boycott of companies from which the Israeli occupation profits or that basically help the Israeli occupation. And some of the major contenders include companies like Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, SodaStream, Caterpillar, which makes the bulldozers. Hewlett-Packard makes the technology that enables the Israeli checkpoints to function. Motorola makes the parts for the drones that attack Palestinians, and on and on. And it's proven, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I know for a fact that the Israeli economy has taken hundreds of millions of dollars losses as a result of BDS, and they themselves continue to acknowledge in the Israeli press how effective it has been in multiple sectors. But, you know, agricultural is one obvious one that we don't always think of. But in the United States, at least, the major consumers of imported Israeli dates, which are grown on illegal Israeli settlements, are actually Muslims during Ramadan. And they're labeled things that we don't always recognize as Israeli, like Jordan River dates or Jordan Valley dates. And from what I understand, it's the same in Malaysia, but it kind of comes through a different route, through Singapore, which imports persimmons and dates, among other things, again, from Israel, grown in illegal settlements that are being consumed by Malaysians. The holdings, perhaps, in companies that either sell arms or others, you know, components to Israel, imports from companies like Intel and so forth. So it doesn't always happen in the most obvious of ways, which is why the average person needs to be really well educated about BDS and how they can support it, because it is the most effective way I think individuals can support the Palestinian struggle.
Yeah, I think, if I may add, it's all about education. Mm-hmm. It's all about education. In fact, we are in the midst actually of discussions with the ministry to actually share what our limited research is all about, some of these companies, and then how will that impact and negatively to the company's local and things. So we don't do just for the sake of doing it. So we do it the purpose, how we do it, what are the implications.
And understanding really what
yes,
you're doing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. There's always alternatives. You don't just boycott the sale of boycotting, but why, mm-hmm. Those are the education that we need to instill upon most of the people here.
I think there's also the element of, if people ask you why you're doing this, you have to be able to answer that. Mm-hmm. And that's where education comes in as well.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I should just add that to answer the why, the main reason why boycott is because it's one of the only ways as an individual that we can hold Israel or the Israeli government accountable for its actions when other options are failing, when world powers are not holding it accountable. And the most obvious example is the way that individuals boycotted apartheid South Africa and proved to be very effective to the downfall of the apartheid regime.
If I can add something, in 2009, all the Christian churches of Palestine united in a statement called the Kairos Palestine, which is modeled after the South African Kairos. It's a moment of truth, a moment in which we have the chance to change things. And in their booklet, in the Kairos document, it specifically calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So this is what the Christian churches are also advising the West. So they are united with, in the call for boycott. And it's a document that you can find online if you want to read it.
Because we're running out of time, I'm just going to bring it back to the film and the film festival. Yasmin, your documentary has been screened at various cities in the US and Europe. You mentioned that a lot of people have communicated to you that they weren't aware of the issues that you raised. What other reactions have you gotten to the film?
For the most part, I've gotten very good reactions. It's a surprise, shock. When the film is finished and the lights go on, people are mute. For the most part, they need to have a moment in which they absorb all the information. It's a historical film. It goes chronologically from before 1948 to present day. People need to absorb all the amount of information that very often has not been told to them, because the main narrative has for 66 years been the Israeli narrative, and the Palestinian narrative has been hidden, has been eaten up, has been completely changed. There are so many things that have not been told. And so people need to realize that the information is there, and Palestinians have a story to tell, even though it has been silenced for so long. And a very important point that I want to make is that very often people think that, okay, land appropriation happened 66 years ago. The destructions, demolition of homes happened in 1948. The truth is that the demolitions are continuing. There is a budget in the Israeli government for demolition of Palestinian homes. They are charged when a Palestinian home gets demolished. The Palestinian family has to pay for the demolition to the Israeli government. Land confiscation keeps on happening. Bethlehem is being shrunk. Right now, the Israeli government has just announced the confiscation of more land just outside of Bethlehem in Wadi Fukin to build a new settlement. So it's not something that happened a long time ago and it has stopped. The land, if you see the film, you will see that some of the Palestinian houses, in my case it's Christian, but it happens to the Muslims the same way, are completely surrounded. One house is completely surrounded on three sides by the wall. The view is blocked. This Claire Anastas, who is the person who lives in this house, was on the main Jerusalem-Bethlehem road, on the road that, everybody walked to, from Jesus himself walked on this road, and now it's blocked by the wall. There is an 8-meter high wall that is blocking it. She not only doesn't have access into Jerusalem, but she is separated from her family, from her in-laws. They are separated by the wall, so she needs a permit to go visit her husband's father and her husband's family. These are things that you don't really think about, that it continues. It's not something that has stopped. It's a continuation. Bethlehem, there is a wall that is going to go through the nuns and the priests in Kremisan in Bethlehem. It's an ongoing thing that is an abuse and is a theft, and is people are losing their livelihood through this confiscation of land.
Uzaidi, besides the participation of Laila and Yasmin, what else can we look forward to during the festival?
Oh, there's another photography exhibition which is very interesting, I would think, because Asma Seba, which is a photographer, an Algerian-Belgium photographer, She will be exhibiting about 24 portraits of ex-prisoners, women prisoners. And if you were to attend the exhibition, there will be some caption on why these women were actually sent to prison. And some of the reasons are really absurd, you know, for not telling them where the husband is and things like that. And then each portrait will also show an object that she has association with. So looking and reading some of this exhibition, these photographs, you should really move someone. The other one that I think will also be interesting is the charity bazaar. A number of things that we'll be selling, including some of the Middle Eastern food and clothing and things like that. Yeah.
The Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival will take place from the 6th to the 7th of September. More information about the festival and Viva Palestina Malaysia can be found at www.vpm.org.my. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Laila Al-Haddad, author and journalist, Yasmin Perni, documentary filmmaker, and Yuzaidi Yusuf, part of the Central Committee for Viva Palestina Malaysia. We've been discussing the question of Palestine, as well as the 3rd Kuala Lumpur Palestine Film Festival, happening this weekend on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.